Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is what democracy looks like. A win for the people.
And I think it is vital that we keep this seat with the Democratic Party, and that I will support him in the election.
A message from the Tea Party. A message that is loud and clear and does not mince words. We've come to take our government back.
Rand Paul defeats the Republican establishment in Kentucky. In Pennsylvania, Joe Sestak defeats the Democratic establishment, beating Obama's pick, Republican-turned-Democrat Arlen Specter. And in Arkansas, incumbent Blanche Lincoln heads to a runoff against union-backed Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter. We'll be joined by the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Nation editor Katrina VandenHeuvel, and others. Then, as people talk politics around the country, a Detroit family mourns the death of a 7-year-old girl, Ayanna Jones, killed in a police raid of her home while she slept next to her grandmother.
I seen the light leave out of her eyes. I knew she was dead. And she had blood coming out of her mouth. Lord Jesus, I ain't never seen nothing like that in my life. And my 7-year-old grandbaby, my beautiful, beautiful, gorgeous granddaughter.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Primaries and a special election were held in 4 states on Tuesday in the 2010 election cycle's biggest day of voting. In Pennsylvania's Democratic primary, 30-year Senate veteran Arlen Specter lost his bid for re-election to Congressmember Joe Sestak. In Kentucky, Tea Party candidate Rand Paul easily beat Secretary of State Trey Grayson in the state's Republican race. In Arkansas, Democratic incumbent Blanche Lincoln is headed into a runoff against Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter. In Oregon, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden easily won his party's nomination to run for a 3rd term. Meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, Democratic candidate Mark Kritz won a special election to fill the congressional seat left vacant by the death of former Congressmember John Murtha. Kritz previously worked as Murtha's aide. We'll have more on Mini Super Tuesday after headlines. Oil from the BP rig explosion has begun reaching ecologically fragile coastal marshes on the Louisiana coast. On Tuesday, thick tides of brown oil washed ashore in South Louisiana, raising fears of a catastrophe for the local seafood industry and a more porous defense against future hurricane storms. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has nearly doubled the size of a fishing ban to cover 19% of the entire Gulf of Mexico. BP, meanwhile, says it's increased the amount of oil being siphoned from the leaking oil well to around 2,000 barrels of oil a day, up from 1,000. But new video footage of the leak, posted by Democratic Senator Bill Nelson, shows the oil's apparently leaking at the same levels of a week ago. The video also appears to show a new breach in the drill pipe. U.S. officials, meanwhile, say they've begun testing tar balls found off Key West, Florida, to determine whether the oil has entered a loop current that could carry it to the Florida Keys and even up the East Coast. The news comes as Interior Secretary Ken Salazar gave his first congressional testimony since the BP rig exploded last month. Salazar acknowledged oversight problems at the Interior Department's Minerals Management Service, but said BP is ultimately responsible for the spill.
We have made it clear from day one that BP is a responsible party to take care of all of the costs associated with this incident, including whatever damages might arise from this incident to natural resources, as well as to people and businesses and communities who might be affected by this incident.
The Minerals Management Service has come under scrutiny following the disclosure it exempted BP from a comprehensive environmental review of the project that resulted in the spill. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon called for a complete overhaul of the MMS.
Mr. Secretary, it is long past time to drain the safety and environmental swamp at the Minerals Management Agency, which, of course, is the lead federal agency over oil drilling. Now, my view is that this agency has been in denial about safety problems for years.
Meanwhile, Tuesday, Senate Republicans blocked for a second time a proposal to raise the ceiling for oil spill liability to $10 billion from the current $75 million limit. In Thailand, leaders of the armed opposition movement known as the Red Shirts have apparently abandoned their rebellion following a major Thai military offensive in Bangkok. Six Red Shirt leaders surrendered after Thai troops stormed their barricaded camp. At least two protesters and an Italian news photographer were killed in the crackdown, bringing the death toll over the past week to at least 42. The raid set off violent incidents around Bangkok, with Red Shirt supporters setting fire to several buildings and storming the offices of a state-owned television station. The U.S. has reached agreement with Russia and China on a draft proposal for a new round of sanctions targeting Iran's nuclear program. The proposal will now go before the U.N. Security Council. The move came one day after Iran reached a deal with Turkey and Brazil to ship most of its enriched uranium to Turkey in exchange for low-level nuclear fuel to run a medical reactor. Speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the deal won't stop the U.S. from pursuing sanctions.
We don't believe it was any accident that Iran agreed to this declaration as we were preparing to move forward in New York. With all due respect to my Turkish and Brazilian friends, the fact that we had Russia on board, we had China on board, and that we were moving early this week, namely today, to share the text of that resolution, put pressure on Iran, which they were trying to somehow dissipate.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban has launched one of its boldest operations to date with an attack on NATO's Bagram Air Base. At least seven Taliban fighters were killed and nine NATO troops were wounded. The Taliban says at least 20 suicide bombers took part in the overnight assault. The attack came hours after the official U.S. death toll in Afghanistan passed the 1,000 mark, with the killing of five U.S. troops in a suicide bombing in Kabul. In Arizona, three of the four protesters arrested at a sit-in Monday at the offices of Republican Senator John McCain have been handed over to immigration authorities for possible deportation. The protesters called on McCain to back the DREAM Act, which would grant permanent citizenship to undocumented workers' children if they completed 2 years of college, trade school, or military service. All three protesters are undocumented immigrants, marking the first known instance students have risked deportation to back immigration reform legislation. On Tuesday, the fourth protester, Raul Alcaraz, a Tucson resident with permanent status, said the students had initially received indications they would not be handed over to immigration authorities.
After that announcement was made, ICE came in a few minutes later. They came in and they came covered, so they weren't identifiable as ICE, but we suspected they were ICE. And then they took each one of them individually out, and then it was announced that they would be taken to ICE. It was confusing because first, you know, in the hearing, we're being told that there's no ICE hold on anybody. And then the next minute, ICE is there questioning people through the back door, taking their stuff. It looked shady. It looked really weird. And so there was moments of confusion, definitely.
One of the students is Mohammed Abdullahi, a gay Iranian national who says he faces persecution if he is sent back to Iran. Student activist Tanya Anzueta also criticized the arrests.
We feel that it's really unfortunate, right, that immigration feels like they should be detaining undocumented students who haven't done anything wrong. And, you know, the reason why they're doing is this precisely because we are looking for a path to legalization through the DREAM Act.
Back in Washington, Senate Banking Committee Chair Christopher Dodd is proposing to weaken the provision on derivatives trading in the financial regulation bill he unveiled earlier this year. Under the current proposal, Wall Street firms would be banned from acting as brokers for most forms of derivatives trades. But Dodd's calling for suspending the ban for 2 years and allowing the U.S. Treasury to cancel it altogether. Here in New York, dozens of protesters gathered outside the offices of the banking giant J.P. Morgan on Tuesday. Sarah Ludwig of the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project said the rally was organized to highlight Chase's opposition to financial reform and refusing to modify loans for thousands of struggling homeowners.
We want Chase to stop blocking financial reform in Congress, first and foremost. They need to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. They need to support basic reforms that have been put on the table. We also want Chase to start modifying these loans. People are desperate. Each one of these loans is a family. It's a street. It's a community that we're talking about.
The rally coincided with a meeting of Chase shareholders. Republican Congressmember Mark Souter of Indiana stepping down after admitting to an extramarital affair with a part-time staffer. Souter made the announcement at a teary news conference Tuesday.
I sinned against God, my wife, and my family by having a mutual relationship with a part-time member of my staff. In the poisonous environment of Washington, D.C., any personal failing is seized upon, twisted for political gain. I'm resigning rather than put my family through a painful, drawn-out process of which any legal question would have been clearly resolved and I would have been exonerated. But the political price to pay and the personal price of my family was not worth it.
Souter has repeatedly billed himself as a family values lawmaker. Last year, he appeared along with the staffer with whom he had had the affair in a campaign video promoting abstinence education. And in West Virginia, two activists are being held on $100,000 bail each following their arrest protesting mountaintop removal coal mining. The activists, Emma Kate Martin and Benjamin Bryant, were detained after blocking the driveway at Amassi Energy's regional headquarters. The group Climate Ground Zero is calling on local officials in Boone County to reduce the bail amount. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the biggest day of voting so far in the 2010 election cycle, the party establishments on both sides of the aisle suffered defeats. In Pennsylvania's Democratic primary, 30-year Senate veteran Arlen Specter loses his bid for re-election to Congressmember Joe Sestak. In Kentucky, Tea Party candidate Rand Paul easily beat Secretary of State Trey Grayson in the state's Republican race. And in Arkansas, Democratic incumbent Blanche Lincoln heads into a runoff vote against Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter. Much of the focus last night was on Pennsylvania, where 80-year-old Republican-turned-Democrat Arlen Specter lost his bid for a sixth Senate seat term despite the backing of President Obama, organized labor, and Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. With nearly all the votes counted, Specter had 46% to Joe Sestak's 54%. Specter delivered a brief concession speech last night.
I have just called Congressman Sestak to congratulate him and to tell him that I think it is vital that we keep this seat with the Democratic Party and that I will support him in the election.
Joe Sestak, a two-term Congress member, is a retired three-star Navy admiral, the highest-ranking former military officer ever elected to Congress. He pointed to his military career in his victory speech last night.
It's no surprise to anyone that people want to change. When I went to Congress just a few years ago, after 31 years in the wonderful United States Navy, I found too many career politicians are a bit too concerned about keeping their jobs rather than serving the public, rather than helping people. In the Navy, we're held accountable for our actions, and we should expect no less from our politicians in Washington, D.C.
Sestak will face Republican Pat Toomey in November. Meanwhile, in Kentucky's Republican Senate primary, Rand Paul, an ophthalmologist and the son of Texas Congressmember Ron Paul, won 59% of the vote, storming past Secretary of State Trey Grayson by a 24-point margin. Rand Paul has the backing of the Tea Party movement and made it clear he's their candidate in his victory speech last night.
I have a message from the Tea Party. A message that is loud and clear and does not mince words. We've come to take our government back. We've come to take our government back from the special interest who think that the federal government is their own personal ATM. from the politicians who bring us oversized fake checks emblazoned with their signature as if it was their money to give. Washington is horribly broken. I think we stand on a precipice. We are encountering a day of reckoning, and this movement, this Tea Party movement, is a message to Washington that we're unhappy and that we want things done differently. We now have a president, though, who apologizes for America's greatness. We have a president who went to Copenhagen and appeared with Robert Mugabe, Hugo Chavez, and others, Evo Morales, to apologize for the Industrial Revolution. They say, these dictators, these petty dictators say, that to stop climate change, it's about ending capitalism. They are explicit, and the president, by attending Copenhagen, gives credibility and credence to these folks, and he should not go.
In November, Rand Paul will face Jack Conway, the Kentucky Attorney General who won the Democratic nomination. And in Arkansas, Democratic incumbent Senator Blanche Lincoln is headed into a runoff election on June 8th against Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter. With about 92% of the precincts, Lincoln led Halter by 44% to 42%. A third candidate, D.C. Morrison, won enough votes to prevent either Lincoln or Halter from crossing the 50% threshold. For more on the results of Mini Super Tuesday, we're joined by a panel of guests here in New York. Katrina VandenHeuvel is with us, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. The Reverend Jesse Jackson also joins us, the founder of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Alexis Simmendinger, a reporter at The National Journal. Joining us on the phone from Philadelphia is Will Bunch, a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News and author of the blog Attitude. Will, let's start with you in Philadelphia. Major upset for the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania. 30-year Senate veteran Arlen Specter, once Republican turned Democrat, has been defeated by a three-star admiral, the two-term Congress member Joe Sestak. Talk about what happened.
Yeah, hi, Amy. Well, Sestak's win was a surprise, but in a way it wasn't a surprise. I mean, one thing about Pennsylvania is that we have a closed primary system, so only Democrats are going to the poll. And, you know, Arlen Specter is a dying breed. I mean, he was a moderate Republican for 45 years, and he was a centrist. And it's just very hard to play to the center. He tried to do that by switching parties twice in his career, once in the beginning of his career when he switched from Democrat to Republican, and then once at the end here where he tried switching back to the Democratic Party. And the people who vote in a Democratic primary in Pennsylvania tend to be the most liberal voters in the state. And we always knew that Specter was vulnerable for an attack because the people who vote in that primary don't like George Bush. They don't like Sarah Palin. And Sestak ran a brilliant campaign. He waited till two or three weeks before the election, and he aired this devastating ad that showed George Bush in all his Bushian glory, praising Specter, and closed with a shot of him on stage with Sarah Palin, and said that Specter changed parties to save one job, his own. And in a year where there's so much anti-incumbency fervor, you know, the idea that Specter was kind of out for himself, which this ad certainly left that impression, was just devastating. And he really was never able to recover.
And President Obama did not actually come into the state for Arlen Specter, though he supported him.
Absolutely. He did do robocalls. Specter countered with his commercial that showed Obama on a stage addressing him. You know, it was kind of weird. In fact, I think Talking Points Memo did a mashup of these two commercials that were running at the same time that looked very similar, except one was Obama endorsing Specter and the other was Bush endorsing Specter. And I think for voters, I don't think the Obama ad helped because it just kind of reinforced the idea of this flip-flop that Democratic primary voters didn't like at all.
Talk about a very significant race that took place in Pennsylvania, which was the one that Jack Murtha's aide actually won. This was the race where Mark Kritz won the special election vacated by the congressman, many-term congressman, who died.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating race, and I think it does give a little bit of hope to the Democrats. It's a very strange district. I actually used to live in that district many, many years ago for a short time, and it's kind of the heart of what you call the Reagan Democrats, which are these pro-union, blue-collar, white, very socially conservative voters. And Kritz was a great candidate. You know, people in that district loved Jack Murtha, the congressman, longtime congressman who died this year, and Kritz really kind of carried on the Murtha tradition. I mean, he was very socially conservative himself. He's pro-gun. He's pro-life on the abortion issue. And it's hard to know what to make of that district. You know, it's the only district in the country that voted for John Kerry in 2004 and then flipped and voted for John McCain in 2008. So it's a very unusual electorate out there. But what he did, Kritz, was he really localized the race, and he kept the focus, I think, off of Obama and off of national politics, and was able to win. And I think that could be instructive for other Democrats running in other races around the country.
Katrina Vandenhuvel, you were looking at that race. You were looking at the Kritz race.
I thought it was an interesting race. It's just as Will describes that district. It's a sort of conservadem district. But I think it was a victory for labor. Rich Trumka, I believe, has a connection to that district. He may
head of the AFL-CIO.
Labor went all out. Get out the vote, 16,000 calls, knocking on doors, 75,000 flyers to 60 work sites. So I think, you know, in his message to that district, AFL President Rich Trumka spoke about the need for jobs at the top of an agenda, and talked a populist message, which I think really resonated in a district which is hurting. And as Will says, it's hard to nationalize that race, but it's a message to Democrats what kind of message they should go out into the country with in this election season.
Because, of course, I mean, Mark Kritz being the aide to Murtha, you couldn't have more establishment than that. I can't remember how many terms Murtha served.
I mean, there's a little bit of an Alice in Wonderland quality this morning, because it is a loss for it's a defeat for the bipartisan establishment. But within each race, there are nuances, because Kritz was part of the establishment, Murtha's longtime aide. And, you know, Specter, it was expediency. Sestak is interesting. He is probably a better candidate against Pat Toomey in the general. But again, on Afghanistan, an issue that hasn't really come up in this election, though we mark a grim marker of 1,000 dead this week in Afghanistan, American soldiers. You know, Sestak is very much on the Obama administration surge policy side, whereas Specter raised some tough questions. So,
and yet, it was Specter who is the Republican candidate for so long, Reverend Jackson, in Pennsylvania. I mean, I think this is the first time that all these Democrats in Pennsylvania would have had to flip and vote for the man they voted against for so many years.
Use the right language. He was seen as flip-flopping. 80 years old, a younger, stronger, more decisive man with a point of view. Democrats could not trust him, they felt. Republicans did not have confidence in him. What strikes me about the race also, you have the kind of urban crisis in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and it was about me, not about poverty and unemployment. It was not running on, if I'm elected, I'll address what's hurting you. There's also Appalachians in Pennsylvania. And for the life of me, how can you run in Pennsylvania and never once mention the word Appalachia, given what just happened with the coal miners' crisis in West Virginia? Never mention Appalachia. Never mentioned the state of emergency that urban Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are in. Like, vote for me. That was not quite enough.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. We'll also be talking about Arkansas and, of course, Kentucky. Reverend Jesse Jackson with us, as well as Katrina Vandenhuvel. Thanks very much to Will Bunch, who is speaking to us from Philadelphia, writes for the Philadelphia Daily News and does that blog, Attitude. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Winter in America, and ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows what to say. Save your soul, Lord knows, from winter in America. The Constitution, a noble piece of paper, with free society, the struggle, but they died in vain. And now democracy is a ragtime on the corner.
Winter in America by Gil Scott Heron. Gil Scott Heron, who's pulled out of a concert in Israel, refusing to sing there now because of what's happening with the Palestinians. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 800 stations on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 250 are. I'm Amy Goodman. We're looking at what's called Mini Super Tuesday. Around the country, the incumbents are in big trouble. We've just talked about Pennsylvania. I want to turn to Arkansas right now. Our guests in studio are Katrina VandenHeuvel. She's editor of The Nation magazine, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Alexis Simmendinger is with us in Washington, D.C., reporter at the National Journal. Alexis, you've been following Arkansas.
Exactly. I spent some time earlier this month tracking Senator Lincoln and her challenger in the Democratic primary, Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter, around Arkansas. And it was a very, very interesting race that Senator Lincoln knew she was in trouble with because of the big money coming from organized labor and MoveOn.org and others in her state to support, actually to recruit and support a challenger in the Democratic primary. In a state that is increasingly conservative, went overwhelmingly for John McCain in the presidential election. And Senator Lincoln has tried, some would say very awkwardly, to be a centrist in her state with a centrist voting record. And she was clobbered over her what they called flip-flopping record on health care, voting in separate votes in the end of 2009 and early 2010 in different ways. So she was condemned for abandoning a public option, insurance option. She originally was supportive of the Employee Free Choice Act, the card check initiative that organized labor was very supportive of, and then she went against it. So Bill Halter swooped in and gave her a run for her money and is now forcing her into the June 8th runoff, which she had been hoping to avoid. So she looks weakened. She had to spend an enormous sum of money to try to combat the outside money that he was raising and spending. And, of course, in a conservative state, it doesn't look that terrific for her in November.
Why was she known as Walmart Senator? Why was Blanche Lincoln seen in that way in Arkansas, Alexis?
She's has a record of being very supportive of the Walmart owners, the corporate entity that supports Walmart, Sam Walton. And she's very—she's been very reluctant to weigh in more decisively to be supportive of the employees of a, you know, enormous business enterprise in her state. She's been much more allied with the corporate ownership and their interests against the employees and their interests in organizing.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, your take on Arkansas right now and what this means, having to—she's forced into a runoff now.
I think it's a very important test for progressives to organize in a conservative state and try in a primary to change the balance of forces, even if Bill Halter, who's no lefty insurgent, but does pose a challenge to Blanche Lincoln and her corporate conservative Democratic policies. I think it's a test. I do think what happened is that Blanche Lincoln became a kind of reborn populist, fighting for a tougher derivatives to curb these speculative instruments. So I think there's a value in that, and I think you know, we need primaries across this country to change the constellation of forces inside the Democratic Party. I don't think this is necessarily a left-right issue. I think it's about working people versus Wall Street, the banks, corporate interests, the Walmarts of the world. And in that sense, this becomes a kind of interesting petri dish, Arkansas, and a state which needs better representation for its working people.
It's interesting you mentioned the derivatives, because earlier in the headlines, saying Senate Banking Committee Chair Christopher Dodd's proposing to weaken the provision on derivatives trading in the financial regulation bill he unveiled. Under the current proposal, Wall Street firms would be banned from acting as brokers for most forms of derivatives trades, but Dodd's calling for suspending the ban for 2 years and allowing the U.S. Treasury to cancel it altogether. And this race was really putting her in a box, forcing her
to be tougher and to show a little bit of populist backbone. I will say, people in Washington expected Dodd Tuesday night, sort of in the dead of the primary night to skewer the possibility of tougher reform. I don't know how that plays going forward, but it may well help Bill Halter in a runoff, because she'll be in a box as to what to say about the establishment Democratic Party's move.
That's a larger Democratic identity crisis. Yeah. Roosevelt had a point of view. These banks are too big, and we should separate them, except trading from lending, put America back to work, chicken in every pot, a foreclosure moratorium. It's like if I win, you win. Now, I may win and you may not win. There's a disconnect. And even all the Wall Street maneuvering, what is so bad about this, that we have bailed out Wall Street, but disconnected from lending up from reinvestment. And that seems that Dodd is making another fateful step backwards, giving Wall Street more and giving 25 million people unemployed less. It seemed, again, the Blanche was also caught in, seen as kind of flip-flopping and kind of a unprincipled position. Arkansas is too poor to be forced to vote rich. if you run an Arkansas campaign on Arkansas's interest, you may prevail and deserve to win.
I just want to go back to Alexis for a minute, because I know you're going to have to leave. This runoff, what's different? I mean, you have D.C. Morrison, who won't be in the runoff. Where will his votes go? Because this is so tight. Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was in Arkansas, it was interesting. The voters that I talked to—Arkansas has early voting, and they started to vote on May 3rd. So when I was there, I actually could talk to voters who were walking into polling places very early. And what they were telling me is that D.C. Morrison, a very conservative businessman with very little funding, very little understanding about what he stood for, was the spoiler, the protest vote. The voters that I talked to were saying that they were trying to send a message to both Senator Lincoln and to Lieutenant Governor Halter, saying that they were, in some ways, very disenchanted with both of them and very upset about their negative advertising, bashing each other over a variety of things that some voters told me they just found to be kind of hyperbole on both sides, so a pox on both of them. So I would imagine that either those voters stand down now going into June, or without D.C. Morrison there, or that they will make a decision one way or the other. I actually talked to some voters who said that they hoped that Blanche would get a message. That was the phrase that I heard. I'm sending Blanche a message. I also wanted to add something about this derivatives, which is very interesting. As you know, the Senate, with Senator Dodd, held back from moving ahead on the portion of the legislation that Blanche Lincoln had allied herself with on the derivatives. Now, as you pointed out, Senator Dodd is about to move ahead and weaken it. So this has turned out to not be a very helpful, as you point out, to her for this primary, since she now has to extend herself into June. But the one thing I want to point out is when I was talking to voters, they were not focused on this. She had hoped that her chairmanship of the Senate Ag Committee would really help her make a case in the state to show that she was a populist. The voters that I spoke with were much, much more focused on her record on health care, and I did not hear anyone talking to me about the banks.
Here's a sampling of what's been on the airwaves in Arkansas in recent weeks.
My daughter Casey has special needs. She faces a lot of health problems, so I worry about health insurance. That's why I'm so upset that Senator Blanche Lincoln voted to allow health insurance companies to deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. I guess Blanche Lincoln sided with the big insurance companies because they could afford big campaign contributions. We need a senator that's going to truly stand up for what the working people need.
SEIU COPE is responsible for the content of this advertising.
I'm Blanche Lincoln, and I approve this message.
If you listen to Bill Halter in his TV ad, you'll notice he never denies outsourcing American jobs to India. Just like he won't tell us what he promised the AFL-CIO, or how he would have voted on the public option, or on the Wall Street bailout. And when asked about his company being sued for cheating investors, he responds with lawyer language.
The lawsuit was settled. The company never admitted to those allegations.
There you have it, the ads on both sides. Reverend Jackson.
Well, you know, we ended up supporting the health care bill that surfaced, but not the one that we fought for. The result is that today the insurance companies, there is no check and balance on insurance companies, are still going out the roof. $2,000 a night for hotel beds. You can buy a medicine in Canada for $200 and on the Michigan side for $1,400. Public option really didn't matter to a lot of people. And there's another case where the health bill was a bold step in the right direction. But giving up public option was a lot. And again, in Arkansas, you have a case of a lot of working poor people who now watch Wall Street rejoicing because it's been bailed out in historic ways. But they're still facing home foreclosures and church foreclosures, student loan defaults. They're among the working poor. And Democrats should have some identity on these issues.
But I thought what Alexis said was interesting, that the voter she spoke to didn't really connect the derivatives reform to a populist message. Part of that is Wall Street winning, that this financial reform bill has become complex in ways ordinary people have a hard time understanding. But it's very clear. It links to the health issue. It's which side are you on? On the side of big insurance companies, big pharma, big money, Wall Street, big oil. And I think that will emerge more clearly, perhaps, in the runoff. But the health care issue is going to be an interesting one to track, and it may well serve the Democrats better than the Republicans have been spinning with all of this talk of nullification.
It'd be interesting to see if President Obama goes to Arkansas and what impact will have in this campaign.
Because he held off this time.
It's a real test of just how deep is our message of health care reform working bottom up.
I would suspect after the SESTAC victory in Pennsylvania, he may not want to put his political capital, which he doesn't put in many places as is, on the line in Arkansas. But you know what? Never say never.
I'm not sure you can avoid either choosing an ally or not. Yeah. There is no answer present. You kind of fall against, and if so, what would the impact of his presence be?
Alexis Semendinger, what about that? What would the impact, and why didn't Bill Clinton go for Blanche Lincoln this time?
Oh, well, President Clinton and President Obama both cut radio ads supporting Blanche Lincoln, Senator Lincoln. And, of course, President Obama, feeling very compelled to support incumbent senators, Democratic senators, has said that he was very supportive of Senator Lincoln. The thing that's very challenging for her, as you can imagine, in Arkansas, which has an undertow of race issues, a long history of that, is that she was trying to position herself in the center, thinking ahead to November. And here she found herself up against Bill Halter and felt that she had to tack slightly through lip service and positioning to the left. Now she's in a primary. She tried to embrace President Obama more closely. I mean, her ads suggested that she was trying to go against Washington, and yet she was very eager down when she needed him to get President Obama to help her. Then, after the primary is over, she is going to have to go to the right again if she wants to try to survive in November. So I think it is a very challenging thing for her as an incumbent, 18 years in Congress, to figure out how she can hug the president of the United States, a Democrat, considered in her state not necessarily the most popular figure, and then still survive in November. It's challenging.
Well, I want to thank you, Alexis Semendinger, for being with us. And I want to go back now in Kentucky to Rand Paul to just play a clip we played earlier. I don't know how many people really got to hear his victory speech last night at a country club in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
His words, "We've come to take our government back." "We've come to take our government back from the special interest who think that the federal government is their own personal ATM. From the politicians who bring us oversized fake checks emblazoned with their signature as if it was their money to give. Washington is horribly broken. I think we stand on a precipice. We are encountering a day of reckoning. And this movement, this Tea Party movement, is a message to Washington that we're unhappy and that we want things done differently. We now have a president, though, who apologizes for America's greatness. We have a president who went to Copenhagen and appeared with Robert Mugabe, Hugo Chavez, and others, Evo Morales, to apologize for the Industrial Revolution. They say, these dictators, these petty dictators say, that to stop climate change, it's about ending capitalism. They are explicit And the president, by attending Copenhagen, gives credibility and credence to these folks, and he should not go.
Katrina Vandenhove.
It's nice to know that the Tea Party headquarters in Kentucky is at a Bowling Green country club. You know, Rand Paul says he wants to take back the government. I mean, he wants to take back the government, as do so many of the Tea Partiers, in a way that Uber strategist Grover Norquist once spoke of, take back the government and strangle it slowly in a bathtub. He wants to abolish the Fed. He wants to abolish the Department of Education. You know, Rand Paul, it's delicious to see Cheney down 2-0. He supported Hutchinson in Texas and Rand Paul's opponent in Kentucky. But this man is a demagogue for forces larger than himself. You know, one can speak of his his anti-interventionist foreign policy, but he didn't bring that up in this race.
And I actually saw him talking about Afghanistan. He didn't sound like he was opposed.
I think that for the voters of Kentucky, Mugabe, who we don't think was in Copenhagen, Evo Morales and Chavez, what do those people have to do with the jobs and the health care a poor state like Kentucky needs?
It's a demagogue. Obama's not an ally of Mugabe, not an ally of Chavez. Yeah. It's amazing to see how a medical doctor can willfully distort truth in ways to appeal to people's fears. I mean, where were these people when Bush came in? We were in a surplus discussing how would we spend a peace dividend. We've now gone from surplus to deficit to debt. We were losing 800,000 jobs a month. Where were we then when we were hemorrhaging at the bottom of our economy? But there's a kind of implicit message here. Again, Kentucky, another state with large slice of Appalachia and poverty, they never mention poverty or the plight of working poor people.
Rand Paul is, you know, he speaks about a broken system, as do the Tea Partiers. And I think we agree we have a broken system, but how they want to repair a broken system is to break it even more.
And who broke it?
There are ways to channel the anger that is real in this country. But the channeling you hear from a Rand Paul is a channeling into a destructive counter force, but I think, you know, moving forward, it's worth noting that the week before, Amy, the Tea Partiers didn't do that well. I mean, you had a set of primaries which went sort of under the radar in Indiana, Ohio, North Carolina. You know, they took out Bennett, but otherwise the record is not as clear. Or Senator Bennett, a longtime incumbent in Utah, but the record's not that clear. And I think it's incumbent upon more, you know, affirmative forces in this country in this next period to channel this volatility, this anger, in a way so we have an economy that works for working people and that isn't kind of ignoring the poverty, the pain, because that can, as we know through history, in other countries in our country, move in a direction we are seeing as we listen to a Rand Paul who speaks lunacy about President Obama wanting to destroy capitalism. I mean, Roosevelt, Obama, these people were great, you know, leaders in ways, but they wanted to save capitalism from its excesses.
But what people see is President Obama, who talked about economic change, certainly, and jobs for working people, aligning himself with the biggest banks and people who are destitute, who are losing their homes, who are losing their jobs, seeing these huge bonuses and incredible profits going to these very banks.
Bad economic policy and suicidal politics. And I think we need to address that.
But they have the same alliances. I met with some people from Kentucky and West Virginia doing a Tea Party rally the day of the health care debate. And the guy also got through some of his fears and anger, and he's fighting for liberty. And Amy had on an oxygen mask trying to breathe, in one pocket a Medicare card, the other a Social Security card, fighting against big government. So what was he?
And he was criticizing you, talking
criticizing
about
big
corruption.
Government. I mean, is Paul against the grants to go to the University of Kentucky or Louisville? Is he against interstate highway? And is he against the government research to deal with black lung disease, a coal miner that dies from black lung disease every 6 hours, most of whom come to the hospital there in the Kentucky, for example? I just think that the kind of attacks on President Obama had the kind of mixed message of, I'm against him. What are you for? What is his plan to deal with poverty and jobs and health care and education? I hear no forward thinking.
And the man who won in the Democratic primary, Jack Conway, beat a man, Dan Mongiardo, who ran against Bunning. Mongiardo was red-baited in an ugly way by Bunning in the Senate election, but some people think Conway has a real chance. I mean, It's not clear Rand Paul is going to run away with it. The numbers were pretty big last night, but he ran against an establishment Republican candidate.
I don't know if this is true. I'm looking at a publication called The Moderate Voice for people who are wondering about his name, Rand Paul. It says he was born Randall Paul. He informally changed his name to Rand during that campaign as a homage to the author Ayn Rand, according to a Ron Paul aide at the time. Well, this is Democracy Now! Katrina VandenHeuvel, thanks very much for being with
us. That's a Democratic act right there, changing your name.
Editor and publisher of The Nation. She blogs at thenation.com. Reverend Jackson's going to stay with us as we move to Detroit and also talk about some anniversaries like Brown v. Board of Education. Stay with us.
Now, people, get together. Here comes our big break. Come now, people, be together. For our children's sake. Right now, right now, right now, right now, now, people. For the time is
Usual Seems Natural by Eric Mercury here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Detroit, a funeral will be held Saturday for Ayanna Jones, the 7-year-old girl who was shot dead by police while she was sleeping in her own home. On Tuesday, a lawyer for Jones' family filed a pair of lawsuits against the Detroit police for the killing that sparked outrage in the Motor City. Shortly after midnight Sunday, police raided the family's home looking for a murder suspect, they said. The raid began when police threw an incendiary device known as a flashbang grenade through a front window of the home. The device reportedly burned the little 7-year-old. She was sleeping on the couch. What happened next is in dispute. Detroit police say the police then entered the home and the girl was shot after Officer Joseph Weekly's gun accidentally went off following a tussle with Ayanna's grandmother. But the family's attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, says he's seen video contradicting the police account of the killing. Feiger says video of the incident shows police open fire before they'd entered the house. A bullet from the gun pierced Ayanna's head and neck. On the night of the raid, the Detroit police officers were accompanied by a film crew from the reality TV show The First 48. The show's network, A&E, has yet to publicly release the video shot of the raid. Meanwhile, the Detroit News has revealed the officer involved in the shooting, Joseph Weekly, was accused in a 2009 federal lawsuit of being part of a team that broke into a home, shot two dogs, and pointed a pistol at children, including an infant. On Tuesday, Ayanna's grandmother, Martella Jones, described the night of the shooting.
As soon as they hit the window, I hit the floor, and I went to reach for my granddaughter. I call her Malia. Her name is Ayanna. Because she's my mini-me. My mini-me. I seen the light leave out of her eyes. I knew she was dead. And she had blood coming out of her mouth. Lord Jesus, I ain't never seen nothing like that in my life. And my 7-year-old grandbaby, my beautiful, beautiful, gorgeous granddaughter. My goodness, what type of people? What type of people? Can't trust the police. You can't trust the Detroit police. You can't trust them. You can't trust them. They wouldn't even let us go check on the other babies. They wouldn't even let us go check on the other kids. They're so rude to us. And when I see y'all done killed my grandbaby, y'all done effed up now. And when I say, oh, sh**, and grabbed her up and ran out the house.
That was Martella Jones talking about the Detroit police shooting that killed her 7-year-old granddaughter, Ayanna. The grandmother was speaking at a news conference organized by the family's attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, who called on the Detroit police to acknowledge how the tragedy unfolded.
For 5 to 15 officers who know what happened, I'm asking that some of them have the ounce of the milk of human kindness to go forward to Chief Evans, go forward to your assistant chief, go forward to your internal affairs, and admit and tell them the truth about what happened. There is a videotape that will show the truth. I'm asking Chief Evans and Mayor Bing to acknowledge that there was never an altercation with Ayanna's grandmother, and that the shot was fired from outside, and that a bomb was thrown onto or next to Ayanna, burning her before she was shot. And I'm asking the powers that be within the administration to apologize to Mertilla, because Mertilla was taken into custody afterwards when the officers attempted to come up with some type of explanation or cover-up or alibi for the shooting. They decided to blame Mertilla, and they claimed that Mertilla was involved falsely in a dispute with them, and so they arrested Mertilla. They handcuffed this grandmother. They took her to the Detroit lockup. They transported her in chains to the Detroit Receiving Hospital to have her drug tested. They brought her back to the Detroit lockup and had her tested for the existence of gunpowder. And then they inexplicably and just quietly let her go. That type of, and then subsequently had a press conference where it was suggested that what the assistant police chief could be believed was that there was an altercation with Mertilla and the gun went off. And that is totally false. Mayor Bing, Chief Evans, I'm asking you on behalf of this family, I'm asking the officers who were present at the scene, come forward now and tell the truth. I saw the videotape. You all know what happened at this scene. Please don't let this child have died in vain. This is an opportunity to come together, not to tear us apart. And I believe ultimately that's what has to happen, that this city not be torn apart, that this city be brought together by an admission by the powers that be that this was wrong, this is what happened. Apologize to this father and this mother and this grandmother. Apologize now, and we can start the road to healing.
That was attorney Jeffrey Feiger. To talk more about the shooting, we're joined in Detroit right now by Ron Scott, founder of the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality. Still with us here in New York is Reverend Jesse Jackson. Ron Scott, thanks for joining us. Talk about what happened and what you're demanding now.
Well, basically, we, and I'm glad Reverend Jackson is with you because he knows the work that we've been doing over the last 15 years in this, and of longer in terms of police brutality in the city. This has been going on for a long time, and what we're speaking to is the policy that was enacted. This policy, we saw an uptick in this in the beginning of this current administration, where in effect a zero tolerance framework was established, and essentially these special response teams, fugitive apprehension teams, multi-jurisdictional task forces, with the aid of federal money, have been conducting military-style raids. And there's even a group here called a gang squad, which has been essentially just terrorizing a number of people. So this was sort of bound to happen. We had tried to raise the cry, raise the question, point out that these kinds of things were over the top. And we were vilified for raising that. At this particular point, it is unfortunate that we've been deemed correct by virtue of such a tragic situation. So we're saying Detroit is under two federal consent decrees. For the last 7 years, they've been under federal consent decrees for issues of force and for issues of confinement, both which affected Mrs. Jones and her family and so forth. And so we're saying that the policy in this situation needs to be changed. We're asking for Judge Cook and the federal court that is overseeing the consent decrees to essentially demand and make sure that the city of Detroit live up to and change rapidly its policies. We're asking that the situation involving these special response teams and the team that did this with this television program following them, that they essentially be disbanded and or controlled so that they don't throw incendiary devices like they're in Iraq or Afghanistan in the homes of people in the city of Detroit. So those are some of the basic things, but essentially this department needs a whole revamping, because it's gotten to the point where, and I can say this to you, Amy, with no uncertainty, that people were demanding that the mayor, that the police chief come there. The people were angry. I don't want to see any civil disturbance or any other issues like that occur. So it's really time for the department to be transformed and to do what the federal government has outlined for it to do very quickly, instead of denying that these issues exist. This policy preceded this tragedy, and we need a change in the policy, because if that doesn't happen, then we're going to have more tragedies like this.
Reverend Jackson, you know Mayor Bing.
Yeah, and I tell you, this is what Ron is saying, and I thank him for his continued work. This is a calamity, a policy, and a pattern. I mean, this is the young man in Rockford this year, shot in the church in the back four times, and they let him walk away. It's a policeman in Philadelphia who shot himself and said a black man shot him. People went looking for the black man who didn't exist. So there's a racial dimension of this, which is volatile and ugly. In the 60s, when these rebellions took place, Detroit was one of those cities. Whenever there was always this kind of police out-of-control behavior, which humiliated people, I mean, there must be something done real quick to stop this. Now, I might add, there were seven other killings within a very short period of time in Detroit during the same time. This is really not just this incident or this case, but as a state of emergency. Chicago, 25 people shot within 12 hours, seven killed. This is a genuine state of emergency across urban America.
We're going to be broadcasting for a week from Detroit in June, and I do hope people tune in. I don't know if you can in any way relate this to this anniversary that you've been writing about, Brown v. Board of Education, 56 years ago. But can you talk about Detroit to 1954 and the significance of this, especially for young people who don't even know what Brown v. Board of Education
is? Well, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we could not sit side by side in restaurants or in movies or in the hospitals or in graveyards. When we tore the wall down, we could not sit side by side. The gap now is not so much horizontal as it is a vertical gap between have and have-nots. There's a racial component. For example, the housing crisis, where banks were able to target, steer, and foreclose on blacks and browns. A black making $100,000 may have gotten a subprime high-priced loan. White making $50,000 may have gotten a prime low-cost loan. The problem is that if I'm in foreclosure, your house is underwater, so neither of us can pay taxes, so we're all in this situation together. So we lose police, teachers, firemen. Chicago, 3,200 blacks die a year from health care disparity alone. All the clout in today's U.S. Today about the radical resegregation of our schools, whether it was the privatizing of schools, a voucher system, or charter systems. The dream of learning to live together, the dream of the great society, the dream of model cities, the war on poverty, that dream must be restored.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Ron Scott, thank you for joining us from Detroit, founder of the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality. We'll certainly continue to follow the story. In 10 seconds, Ron, what are you calling for right now?
We're calling for the prosecution of the officer. We're calling for revamping of the policy. We're calling for the mayor and the chief to step out and, I agree, offer an apology at the very least for this, and to honor the framework of the federal consent decree. It's within the hands of the mayor and all of us to come together and
we're
make
gonna
a joint
have to
statement
leave it there.
About resolving
Reverend Jackson,
this matter.
I want to thank you for being with us as well. I mean,
thank
Goodman,
you.
Thanks so much for joining us.